Thanks for the introduction, and thank you guys for having me. Thank you, Bill, for reaching out and inviting me along. I really appreciate it. Hope you guys get something out of the talk. This is a talk that I gave once before at UCLA. So we'll see how we go. If I just as a yes.
Can you stand to the side so those you're not looking at us on the screen?
I can. Unfortunately, I have to go over there and press the key every now and then. Excellent. Thank you. I think the right arrow. Yeah. Cool. I did want to say I prefer a kind of a conversational style. I'm not a very formal speaker, so if you guys have questions, if something pops in your mind, just shout it out, and we'll. Oh, good. We'll address it on the spot. I think we get a much better interactive thing rather than me standing up here and just bleh at you for half an hour. Next slide. One more. Just to set the stage, as we mentioned, CDN stands for Content Delivery Network. I'm going to briefly go over what a CDN is and what the rate-limiting component of a CDN is all about and why it's important. Then I'm going to dive into a little bit of the technical details on how we've chosen to implement rate limiting, and then wrap up. And as I said, questions all the way through is definitely best for me. Thank you. Okay, so, what is a CDN and how does it work? So, say you have a website, and your website is hosted in LA. You have users, because you're a very successful website, all around the world. So you have users in, looks like Scandinavia, Australia, and Argentina, say, as well as the East Coast. The idea here is that it takes much longer, it takes much longer for someone in Australia to connect to your website and to get content being that they're in Australia. Just the amount of time that it takes the information to flow backwards and forwards is a lot greater, on the order of, you know, 200 milliseconds, which doesn't sound like a lot. You have to go back and forth many, many times to get anything useful from a modern website that have, you know, JavaScript and images and style sheets, as well as the plain, you know, layout itself. Where a CDN comes into play is its ability to store the pieces of the website which are most important and aren't changing closer to the people using it. So the yes. Oh, we'll get to it. Yeah, but just to answer your question, the overall idea is that any machine that is serving anything, whether it's a website or files that power a website, can only do a fixed rate of requests. So. Totally. Oh, that's good. I'm very happy to address questions, and I have, thank you. Please keep interrupting me.
This is another PhD.
Good.
I'm a kiddie, but I'm not a computer.
No, I totally get it. I totally get it. If you came up here and gave a presentation, I would be lost in 2 seconds. I totally understand. And I'm not interested in giving a presentation that people don't get, so please slow me down as much as possible. So caching, the idea of caching is to put content that you use a lot closer to you. An analogy is, let's say you have a book that you read all the time. The book you read most often, it's your favorite book. It might be sitting by your bedside table. Let's say you have another book that's like, you read it every now and then, maybe once a year, that might be in your bookshelf. Let's say you have a reference book or the encyclopedia. That's at the library. So it's easier to just reach over to your bedside table and get it. And you do that a lot, you would say that that book is cached versus something that's at the library that you have to hit, get in the car and drive down and check it out and much more painful. So the idea of caching is to put things that you use a lot closer to you. Yeah. So a CDN is basically caching for your website so that anyone around the world can get as much of your website as quickly as possible. There's a very good reason for that. Most people have websites to make money. It's unfortunately just the world that we live in. The way websites make money is by attracting people. And one thing that people hate doing, myself included, is waiting. People don't like waiting for anything. And there's a very clear, I don't have it on me because it's not mine, but there's a very clear trend between the amount of time that you take to serve your website and the amount of people that will stay on the website. I believe it's around 3 to 4 seconds. If you can't get your entire website to someone in 3 to 4 seconds, they're gone. Which for businesses running websites, you know, your Amazon, Google, that's money that's lost. So they're very invested in getting their websites to be delivered to their users all around the world as fast as possible. Okay, we're not on to the next one yet. Sorry, Stephanie. That's good. So how do you get onto a CDN? Let's say you have a very successful website and you're hosted in LA and people in Australia are complaining. Or you notice that the number of people buying your products in Australia and Norway is greatly reduced than people in Southern California. You might be like, well, how can I address this? One of the ways is to make your website faster. So you come to Verizon and you will say, hey, can you guys help me make my website faster? And we would obviously say yes. So the idea here is that we put our caching server, i.e. bedside table, all around the world. We give every one of your users in every geographical region their own bedside table, and we make sure that most of your website is sitting on it. So that from their perspective, when they want to view your website, it's taking a book off the bedside table rather than going to the library. Everyone with me? Okay. Cool. Thank you. There's a very famous quote, and I'm going to mess up the attribution, but you guys can go and Google it later. The quote is, there's only two hard problems in computing. Cache invalidation, which is what I'll talk about in a second, and naming things. So the idea of a cache, something that's very tricky, is what do you put on the bedside table? Which book? If we have our bedside table in Australia, and we have all of Australia to serve, which books do we keep there? Which books do we send back to the library because no one's reading? Which books do we keep on the bedside table?
Only
you can keep whatever you want. We're totally unbiased. What's that? You would think that, right? Yeah, absolutely. And you're totally right. For most websites, it's there. Like when you go www.google/, it's that page. It's the initial landing page because that sets the tone for the rest of your website. If that comes back immediately, people are like, oh, cool website. And then there'll be more, you know, they'll be slightly less tolerant if the next page takes a little bit longer. But if that first page is slow, they're out of there. They're somewhere else. So the way that this works is someone joins the CDN, and initially we don't have any of their books on any of our bedside tables. We don't have any of their website anywhere in the world. The first time someone makes a request, that's indicating to us that someone wants to visit that website, someone wants to read the book. So we go back to the library for you, and in this case, the library is the customer's server in Los Angeles, and we go and get it, and we bring it to the new bedside table, i.e. the cache server over in Australia will follow the red line to the server in Los Angeles, get the content, and bring it back. The idea there being that from then on, everyone in Australia, all those users in Australia, even though there's only one, which is about accurate, Australia's pretty small, will use the green line to go and get the content for your website. The green line is shorter, and literally in this diagram, shorter is faster. So when I first joined the CDN, I was just dumbstruck by how much time and energy and money was involved in such a simple concept. Like, this is a whole world to me that was just invisible. It was like the electric company. I'm like, I don't know. I just plug my thing in and it works, right? There's this whole infrastructure that powers this massive amounts of internet traffic. We were a very small startup company called Edgecast that was acquired by Verizon a couple of years ago. And at that point, we were doing, I think, 4% of the world's internet traffic, which even to my ears now, I was like, oh, so what? That's not that much. It's an enormous amount of traffic. It's terabytes of traffic every second. It's a lot.
Terabytes per second.
I think we're doing 6% now. We were doing, so in 2010 or 2011, we were doing 1 terabyte, and that was 4% of the internet. Now we're doing 5 terabytes, and that's only 6% of the internet. So everybody is growing. It's crazy. One other thing. I think I got that. If you go to a website and we don't have it in cache or locally, we go back to the customer's origin to fetch it. That's the idea. Next slide. Thank you. Okay, so rate limiting. I think I got I don't know if I addressed your question on what rate limiting is, and I apologize for that. I'll go into it right now. So any piece of machinery, especially something that's serving websites, is basically has a maximum amount of work that it can do. So we may have a very expensive machine sitting in these boxes, sitting in these data centers in Australia and Norway and London and all around the world, and they may be able to do 10,000 requests per second. That's it. That's all they can do. They can do 10,000 requests per second and anything more, and they start slowing down. And unfortunately, lots of times they slow down in such a way that it degrades everyone's performance. So you would think, and this is totally our bad, but you would think that if you sent 20,000 requests, it would still serve 10,000 requests. Unfortunately, that's not the way that it works. If you send 20... Yes, it's exactly like a highway. You get a traffic jam. Yes, if you get too, that's a perfect analogy. If it gets too crowded, you have a traffic jam and no one's going anywhere. Which is totally our bad. We are working on it, but it's just the way of the world at the moment. So why do we want to do rate limiting? Why do we want to keep the highways clear? Well, because this is a great analogy. Thank you. The CDN infrastructure is shared across all our customers. So we have one data center in Melbourne, one data center in Sydney, one data center in LA, and I think we have 40 data centers all around the world. But any customer can use any of the data centers. So when one customer's website gets a huge spike in traffic because they have a sale on whatever day of the year, anyone else on that, anyone else across, and we have, 40,000 customers, if that particular customer's traffic starts degrading the performance of the CDN, everybody suffers. So we don't want to do that. We want to keep all the highways clear so all their customers can use them and they can work pretty well. Next. A second aspect of this, which is, again, unfortunate, but also just a reality, is that there are people out there who are interested in taking down websites for monetary gain, whether it's a competitor who is paying someone on the black market to, hey, if you take down my competitor's website, then more traffic will flow to my website, which is totally true and totally illegal, but it's still a good deal of regularity. So the common term for what this is called a distributed denial of service attack, or DDoS, which is exploiting the fact that servers can do a fixed amount. If you can send more than the server is capable of doing, you will eventually make that machine fall over, and then it will be able to do zero. When that happens, you've effectively taken your competitor's website offline. So people out there are motivated to take other websites offline. Some of the websites that they're trying to take offline are customers' websites. So it's my job to try to stop that from happening. Again, why do we want to do this? Because customers get attacked a lot. It happens a lot. and it's kind of a constant battle. So this whole talk is basically a peek under the hood of what we're building to try to be better able to do our jobs. So, yes?
Is most of that by their competitors or other vendors?
Actually, a lot of it, it's very hard to attribute who it is. So whenever we get a request that's sending, that is, whenever we get a particular website getting attacked, we find that it comes from IP addresses and machines all over the world registered to thousands of different people.
So
this is botnets? Yes, this is botnets. Typically. That machine might be doing it right now if it's infected with a piece of malware, and I might have no idea. I had to put the blame on me, even if it's my machine. Someone may have compromised the machine and compromised 10,000 machines around the world, and they're just tricking them into doing it, and people have no idea.
High school boys do it for fun, Look what I did.
Oh, totally. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, anyone could be one of our customers, but the service is reasonably expensive. I think at cheapest, or at least this particular platform is on the order of $10,000 a month. So yes, Hulu, Twitter, Pinterest, enormous websites, Etsy, they're all their customers. So how do we go about rate limiting? Well, the answer is really carefully. If we rate limit it too much, then we're denying legitimate customers access to the websites, and that's exactly the opposite of what our customers want. So we have to be very, very careful about who we let through, who we don't let through, and how long we don't let people through for. Honestly, we're still in the process of deploying this solution, so we're kind of putting it out there, and we're going to be seeing how it goes. So we'll see. Next. Oh, here's a chart in my presentation. So, sorry, it's a lot of text. This is basically a graph of the frequency with which we receive DDoS attacks for the four prior years, 2011 through 2018. Oh, that's the frequency. So, for example, in... No, it's just a count. So, in 2014, we got attacked around 45 times. Once a week.
Okay, but how many websites are you carrying?
Oh, this is across all the websites.
I know, but how many?
How many websites? So we carry around 60,000 websites.
60,000.
Well, it could be the same website 40 times.
Yeah.
It's actually a very tough thing to determine a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I can go into more details on that later. Yeah. Yeah, kind of. And don't get me wrong, some of this data is skewed because before 2011 we didn't really collect anything. We just went down all the time. So that was not a good situation to be in. So we're getting much better at detecting DDoSes and pushing back and, you know, defending the network. So there is some skew in the data, but this trend is pretty clear. Yes? DDoS is distributed denial of service. So the basic intent is that the distributed component is that you have lots of people attacking you. So it's not just one machine. Lots of people attacking you. So this is lots of users involved, basically. And that ties into the denial of service component. To successfully pull off a denial of service, you have to be able to send more requests than the server can respond with. So it's literally just an arms race. So we upgrade our hardware, they get a bigger botnet. And unfortunately, it's actually way easier to get a bigger botnet. They don't have to buy anything. They just... it's totally illegal. Completely illegal. Yeah, it's... I don't know, to be honest. I feel like the law in this area is... I think the way the laws are written is actually okay. Like, you can't go to someone's store and, like, smash in the windows. You know, you can't attack someone's business in that way. Adding all this abstraction in the middle where, you know, if you go up to the store, there's a video camera, and it's you. It's very clear. But all of a sudden, if you're on the other side of the world and you're sitting in, you know, as you said, your mom's basement, punching some keys, you're a long way away from the website that you're attacking. And it's easy to add hops in the middle. So some acquaintances of mine are, in their former days, were cyber criminals. Not particularly interested in DDoS. It's mainly like organized crime. Because they can charge people. It's like, well, if you pay us $10,000, we'll take down your competitor's website for a day. Yeah. Oh, she was saying that kidnapping went down a lot after the penalty for kidnapping went up after the Lindbergh baby. So I guess the idea being that if you impose severe enough penalties, there'll be, you know, the kind of disincentive to do the crime. I don't know of anyone that's ever successfully been prosecuted for this sort of attack. Because, yes. Romania more. Yeah, no, that, I mean, that's exactly the issue. Like, because all of a sudden you're not dealing with, you know, this little geographical area, and now all of a sudden you're dealing with countries. How do you prosecute someone in Russia, even if you can prove that it was them? Like, how does a US-based company do that? It's and it just doesn't happen. That's how they do it. They don't do it. Instead, someone pays me a bunch of money to make sure that even if they try, it doesn't work. So it's actually very interesting stuff. But yeah, the law is clear, I think. I'm not a lawyer, but the law seems very clear. It also seems totally unenforceable. Like, you can't do anything about it. But hopefully something like that will change eventually. Unfortunately, I'm not sure if we want it to get it to change. We would have to give up a lot of the anonymity, which has kind of been the cornerstone of the internet. So I guess that's an interesting question for society to ponder over the next decade or so. Thank you. So, what is the goal of rate limiting? I think I've covered this a little bit, but we'll rehash it. The goal is to limit the amount of requests that are hitting either the edge servers, and I must apologize for injecting the word edge. The edge is the term that CDNs, and only CDNs, give to all the cache servers around the world. I'm not sure why. it's just what it's called. So basically what I'm saying in this slide is that someone can attack a website, and that website is, because we sit between the customer and the website, they're effectively attacking us. When they do that, we can fall over, or may be able to handle it just fine. But everything that's not in cache, everything that those machines don't have, if we are going to the customer's website, you know, say Etsy.com, if they ask for, you know, an image or whatever, or a homepage, and we don't have it, and we go to Etsy.com, and then an attacker asks for a different image, and we go and get it, and a different one, and we go and get it. Even if we are fast enough to ask for all of them, Etsy.com might not be fast enough to respond with them. So either our infrastructure can go down, or our customer's infrastructure can go down. Either way, the website goes offline. Any questions? Nope.
Yeah. How are these caching locations organized? Does somebody say, okay, you got to cache this, you got to cache this? I have to pay so much to cache my web pages.
So it's organized based on, it's basically what's called least recently used. Remember I said there's two hard problems in computing, cache eviction and naming things. LRU, or least recently used, is a cache eviction policy. So the idea being that we have X amount of storage, and we'll just keep filling things up. We'll just keep adding things into the storage until we're full. And when we're full, we go through and be like, okay, what's the thing that's been used least recently? I.e., I'm, you know, now the bedside table, and if I take the books off and put the books on, take the books off and put the books on, and every time someone wants a book, I take it from wherever it is in the stack and I put it on top. Eventually my stack gets full, and what I say is, I'm going to take whatever books are at the bottom, because no one's read those for ages. If they had, they'd be at the top. I'm going to take whatever books are at the bottom and I'm going to throw them away.
And what about refreshing?
Refreshing in what sense?
Well,
It's very interesting, actually. So that's a whole other system that I can talk a long time about. That's called purging. So the idea is so basically the question was, when the website changes, how does the edge, or how do the caches know that it's changed? Otherwise, they could just be serving up an old version of the file, right? So we have a whole system dedicated to purging old content. So basically, there's two approaches. The first one is the customer explicitly tells us that their website has changed. So Etsy.com goes to us and says, hey, Etsy.com's changed. Get rid of the old one that you have. And then we go all around the world to every cache machine. We have around 12,000 cache machines around the world. And we go and basically delete the file from all of them.
Is there a time-to-live concept applied?
Yes. That's the second way that it works. The Etsy.com can tell us ahead of time, here's my homepage, and it's good for 60 seconds. Or it's good for a day, or it's good for however long that they want. And then if someone comes in after that, we say, oh, we have this file, but it's old, so we have to go and get it again. Yeah. So it can, you can be kind of active or passive. The active way is explicitly get rid of the file, and the passive way is just letting it expire, letting it time out. Cool. So going back to the other idea of the cache servers can be hurt, or the origin servers can be hurt, as we call them. So if you remember the map, if the attacker successfully takes offline the cache servers in Australia, or the customer server that's in Los Angeles, effectively the website goes down for people in Australia. So what I'm saying here on this point is that all the machines in Melbourne could be hurting the server in Los Angeles, or the machines in Norway could be hurting the server in Los Angeles. Any of the 12,000 machines around the world could be sending too many requests for the customer's website to handle. I feel like I didn't do a good job explaining that. Should I just try again? We got it? Okay. Oh, okay. So what this means is that you can't just focus on one piece of the pie. You can't just look at all the servers in Australia. Because while you're looking at all the servers in Australia and you're looking at all the servers in London, say, individually they might be okay, but collectively they might be too much. Because any one of them can talk to the customer's website. So as an example, the customer's web server might be able to do 10,000 requests per second. Let's say we have 10,000 machines on the network. We could say every server is allowed to do exactly one request per second. And if we say that, then no one will ever be able to do 10,000 requests per second, and we will never take the customer's web server offline. The problem with that is that it's divided evenly, and that may not be the way that the customer's users are. What they may want to happen is 9,999 requests might be coming from continental United States, and one request is coming from Central America. They don't care where it's coming from. It's 10,000 to them. But for us, we wouldn't, if we use a naive system like that, we wouldn't actually let the full 10,000 through, so then the customer is losing money. Still with me? Okay.
Talking about
All the clients of the website will automatically get routed to the cache servers in Australia. Yes. And that happens actually totally transparently to us. There's this very cool technology called BGP, which is Border Gateway Protocol, which basically means, hands up who knows what an IP address is. Okay, good. So an IP address is basically a unique number that identifies you on the internet. Typically identifies a machine on the internet. It's your address, if you will. And it's unique across the world. So Stephanie has an IP address at home, and I could go to Australia and talk to her using just that number.
And that device.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Every device has its own IP address, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. An edge server is also a cache server. I apologize. I should have kept the names the same. An edge server is the same thing as a cache server.
Edge is a geographical region.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's from the CDN's perspective, it's like the edge of the network. As soon as you go past that, it's like clients. I think that's why they do it, because there's a whole lot of work that happens on all the network layer stuff, routing everything from there back, because we have control of it, whereas we don't have control of the last mile to the client. So I think that's why they make the distinction and they call it the edge. I'm sorry. I should go through and just change everything to cache. So just to harp on that previous point, we need to have a global picture of what's happening. The reason being, the customer's website can get hit from any machine around the world. We have to count them all together to understand what the client's, sorry, what the customer's website is seeing. Additional challenge is that cache/edge servers, as well as customer servers, can get into trouble very, very quickly. So the time that we're talking about is on the order of 120 seconds. If someone is able to send kind of unfiltered requests at a website for 120 seconds, there's a reasonable chance that you can, in sufficient volume, there's a reasonable chance you can, if not take it completely offline, severely impact the performance of it for a period of time. I.e., you can still do damage to a website within 2 minutes. So all the systems that we build need to be able to analyze what's happening and respond in less than 120 seconds. It doesn't sounds like an eternity, and it is an eternity in computing time, except when you're dealing with a global view of the world. So the time it takes for everyone around the world to kind of agree on what the hell is going on and then take action and tell everyone else what action they're taking is easily going to be able to go above 120 seconds. Especially at the scale of like 12,000 machines.
Mm-hmm. Massive amount of data circling the globe and the net.
Yeah.
It's a giant packet switching network.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about different ways all these zillion packets every millisecond are being managed.
Right.
That's what this thing in essence is.
I would say yes, but it's not exactly at the packet layer. It's one step higher than that. So all the packet stuff is kind of difficult to change. The BGP protocol that determines how traffic gets routed around the internet is slow to respond because it also is a global network. It takes a long time for a change to make its way out there. The level that we're dealing with is HTTP requests or requests to websites. So you make a request to a website, I make a request to a website. Yes, all those requests are constituted by little packets of data zipping all around the place, but we kind of assume that all that is good. It would be a much more complicated system if we had to fix that too, so I'm grateful that we don't. I mean, it's basically binary encoded text. Like, you can read it. I could just write one for you. It's super easy. But, it's a reasonably simple-looking little protocol. It's cool. Okay. Hello. How are we going to try to do rate limiting, given the challenges of being forced to have a global view of the world, so that we can actually understand what everyone around the world is doing to one of our customers. And having to do that and make a decision and then take action on the decision in a few minutes or around 120 seconds. So how are we going to do that? Next slide. So I guess listening requirements, we need a shared view of the world. We need low latency, i.e. the ability to make the decision quickly and then push the action out quickly. And quick action propagation. So the algorithm that we came up with is kind of this presentation. Please interrupt me with questions because this stuff is reasonably complicated. But it's weird. It's reasonably complicated, and at the same hand, it's actually also just common sense. It's this weird mix, which is one of the things I really enjoy about my job. Anyway, so the first step that we decide is that every server gets to do their own share independently. What do I mean by that? What I mean is, let's say, just for the sake of simplicity, because there's going to be diagrams for this in a couple of slides, let's say we have exactly 4 cache servers around the world. And let's say the limit is 1,000 requests per second. Just with the most naive implementation possible, we could say that each one of those 4 is allowed to do 250 requests per second. If each one is allowed to do 250, it's impossible globally for them to go above 1,000. Simple, right? So the idea is that's what you're allowed to do, and you don't need to talk to anyone else. Yes?
And what happens to 1,001?
Sorry, I don't mean to push you off. That's in a couple of slides.
Okay.
I'll walk you through. Yeah, I'll walk you through exactly kind of what happens. So each server gets to do its own share completely independently. If it goes above its share, then it needs to start asking its neighbors, "Hey, what are you doing?" Because it's free. Yes.
By neighbors, you mean the other
servers. Yes. The other three. So the use case there is, well, like, why we do that is, let's say that, you know, the four of us are lined up right here, and we know that it's 1,000 per second. And two of us are really close to each other, and two of us are kind of on the other side of the world. I can talk to I'll use this analogy. Two of us are here, and two of us are at the end of the room. I can talk to this guy just by whispering, it's fast. I have to shout all the way over there. So I'll just say to this guy, "Hey, dude, we're allowed to do 500 between us. How many are you doing?" If he says one, then I'm like, sweet, I get to do 499. And we're still good. The two of us are still will not exceed 1,000 per second. And then, so we do that, and then all of a sudden now I'm doing 500, and I'm like, uh-oh, how many are you doing? If he says 10, I'm like, uh-oh, 510 is more than our share, so we need to ask the guys at the end of the room. Then we can say, we're doing zero. We're like, excellent. Now I can do, as you know, and it just keeps going round and round and round, and we keep asking and asking until they come. Sorry, what? Oh. We keep asking until we all agree that we're doing too many. That's basically how it works. And there's a whole diagram for this in the next couple of slides. Okay. One more. We'll leave it on that point. This is kind of a key realization that we had kind of partway through developing this. Because it's difficult to talk to everyone all the time. It's difficult for me to talk to this guy when I'm busy doing this, doing my job of like serving websites. And it's even harder for me to talk to the people at the other end of the room just because it takes longer. Everything takes time, and everything that takes time is time that I'm not spending doing my job. So I don't like doing that. So what we didn't want to happen was every time we go above the limit, we don't want to have to communicate with other people to work out which we're going to drop and which we aren't going to drop. So we take a very simple approach. Again, we're going to reinforce this in the next couple of slides, but let's say the request rate goes up very, very quickly. So we ask, and we're all good, and then we ask in 5 seconds, and all of a sudden we're double the limit. We ask 5 seconds, right now, we ask, and we're doing 500 requests per second. 5 seconds later, we ask, and all of a sudden we're doing 2,000 requests per second. Just because the amount of traffic that came just went up like that. At that point, the decision that we make is, okay, I'm doing 2,000, my limit is 1,000, I'm going to discard and reject 50% of the requests. And that will bring me back down to my 1,000 limit that I want to be at. So the key there is that percentage is applied randomly to all the traffic. So it's not like if you get in first, you'll get a website. You have just as much chance of getting dropped. It's a total random sampling approach. The idea there is that, say someone does get rate limited and we accidentally rate limit a genuine customer and they're just kind of caught in the crossfire for someone else attacking the website. If that happens, we expect them to retry. So even if that, like, we're trying very hard to make sure that doesn't happen. If it does happen, there is some expectation because that's a real person, they'll just click refresh and they'll try again. And then the odds of them getting, you know, randomly denied access to a website twice in a row is hopefully a lot less. Yes, question.
I have a question. If you're going to be dropping a certain percentage, how is that decision made which ones to drop?
It's completely randomized.
Have to do the prior history then?
Nope. Maybe eventually we'll get there because that would be smart, right? The idea there, I assume, would be, well, this IP address has been a legitimate user of the website. You know, they come through every day, blah, 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 blah. And I'm seeing them, so I'm not going to drop any of their traffic because I know that they're good. That is a much better design or design goal. The problem, as we... Yes, that I don't have any time to implement it, and the sheer amount of storage requirements to remember that is enormous.
Would that be a function of the final server? Would that have the previous history of what slice?
Which final server do you mean?
The customer server.
Oh, the customer server.
Which IP addresses are the most useful to them?
Yes, absolutely.
They would set the priority. So
absolutely. And they...
Yep.
Absolutely. If the customers want to do that with the system that we have, they absolutely can. The problem is no one is going to do that, unfortunately. Just because, these customers, they just want their website to work, basically. They're managing IP addresses. They don't want to be telling us. They don't want to be doing any of that. All they want to do is be like, just pay someone, write someone a check once a month, and my website works. It's the way that it is, unfortunately. But you're absolutely right. It will be much better for them if they would keep track. Part of the... you're absolutely right. So the kind of scenario that we're working on is there is a limit of 1,000 requests per second. There's 4 machines around the world, and they're each doing 250 requests per second. So that's a scenario that we're working on. To illustrate that, the limit is 1,000 requests per second. Here's our fun little diagram from earlier. So we have 4 machines around the world, and they're each doing 250 requests per second. And this might be the normal situation for a particular website, which would be cool. Then something happens, and now all of a sudden the cache servers... Does this have a laser pointer? Nope. Oh, here it is. The big green thing. The cache server right here is now doing 1,250 requests per second. So it alone is doing 1,000 requests per second more than it's allowed to. So what do we do? Well, following the algorithm that we were talking about before, that machine goes, 1,250 is greater than 250, so I need to talk to people. In this simpler scenario, just because it gets super complicated if there's multiple levels, in this scenario, that machine is going to talk to everyone and find out what they're doing. So it goes, that seems strange. Sends requests out, which are the green lines, to every other cache server and says, hey, how many requests are you doing? Oh, sorry, I put the mic on this button. Is that any better?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So the machine that has gone above what it's allowed to do independently would then go out and ask all the other machines, what are you guys doing? Those machines respond, and it goes, oh, geez, 2,000 is way more than 1,000, so I need to do something. And what it says is everybody, collectively, we're all going to drop 50% of our traffic. We're doing 2,000 requests per second globally. We want to be doing 1,000 requests per second globally, so 50%. Can just get dropped on the floor. And what we would end up with is this situation. Everyone drops their connection rate in half. So the ones that were doing 250 now do 125. The one that was doing 1,250 now does 625. And then at this point, we're back to being 1,000 requests per second, and the system's good. Yes? From these ones. Yeah. So this system is far from perfect. Yeah, so the it's the lesser of two evils, unfortunately. It sucks. but it's better than the site going down entirely and then you're completely hosed. Right. We could say 1,000 requests per second is infinitely more than 0 requests per second. Yes?
So if I as a user, would notice if I was a user, right, then if you know if you have a red check or you have an error 404 or something?
It wouldn't be a 404, but yes, an error that you got. It would probably be...
Then it would say,
That's indicative of an issue in the system. It may not be a DDoS. There's a million reasons why things can go wrong, unfortunately. But a DDoS is definitely one of the scenarios. Yeah. I mean, if you don't have any protections, that is what will happen. Yeah?
Would it be possible to train your service that now knocked out a certain percentage of incoming requests to recognize the IP address that they knocked out, and then if they see that come in 5 minutes from now, give it a priority?
You mean prioritize up requests that you know are good or down requests that you know are bad?
You've seen an IP address come in.
Oh, I see. To make sure that you don't fail many times. Right. We're definitely going to let them through.
Say, I want to make sure that request comes
through. Yeah. I mean, what's that? Yeah. I mean, theoretically, absolutely. The downside... No, totally. The downside there is that we have to build a system that will work for a lot of IP addresses. Each IP address is 4 bytes or 4 characters, old school, 16 characters, new school. And that multiplies up very, very quickly. The old school, you can have 4 billion approximately, 4.2 billion IP addresses that may be talking to you. You'll never actually get that, but theoretically that's what you could get. 4.2 billion times 4 is a lot. Basically, it's on the order of, what is it, like 16 gigabytes. So what that would, we could do it, absolutely, but that would mean that each machine needs to remember up to 16 gigabytes of information all the time.
And process it quickly.
We could actually do that. We could process it quickly. The problem is that we're a cache. So and we have a fixed amount of storage that we use for everything. So hopping all the way back to my ridiculous bedside table analogy, that would then mean that the size of the stack of books that we get to keep is 16 gigabytes smaller, which means that the whole system is less effective. It's just a trade-off. We could do it. It's hard. Yeah. In certain situations, yes. Typically what you find, for some reason, in like the early 90s, mid-90s, there was this massive, you know, the kind of the dawn of the internet, if you will, there was this enormous investment in infrastructure. So I think there are like over 200 fiber optic lines that run from the west coast of the United States to Asia Pacific. So that means that like 200 separate companies were like, I know, I'm going to run this super expensive cable for thousands of miles halfway across the world. And somehow I'm going to make money after that. I don't know how that... They didn't make any money. They all went bankrupt. But what happened at the end of it was we now have 200 fiber optic connections just on that particular part of the world alone. So the very long-winded way of me saying the actual cables very rarely get overloaded. Are very rarely overloaded, almost never. There's so many of them, and there's such a level of redundancy that like hundreds of them would have to get overloaded at once. What does get overloaded is the pieces of hardware at either end, the routers. So the routers that we use in our data centers are called carrier-grade routers, which means they're the same boxes that are powering the telecommunications industry. So one of those setups for one of our data centers is on the order of $800,000. And they're very good, but even they will get overloaded and fall over.
Talking about hardware, you mentioned that a data center that Verizon has all over the world and many other companies do too.
Oh, yeah.
If you would physically transport all of us right now to the front door of one of those data centers through it, what would we see?
Yeah, I wish I had photos. I could probably pull up some photos, but it's basically, yeah, racks. It's a server farm. I mean, it looks, it's just like, it's called a cab. It's just a cabinet. It's literally just, I mean, it's like this metal structure about yay high. And they have lots of slots that are called blades. And they just plug machines into them. I don't know how big they are, actually. They're about yay. I'm sorry. I'm there you go. I'm pretty bad at hardware, in case you hadn't noticed. It's definitely not what I'm good at. But yeah, I mean, and depending on the data centers, we have 3 data centers in downtown Los Angeles in different facilities. The most impressive one is, it's very pretty. There's flashing lights all over the place and crazy amounts of fiber optic cable going like up the ceiling and running all over the place. It's pretty cool. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So the way they do that is, you know, you have a rack here, and then you have a rack here. One side of the rack is a hot side, and the other side is a cold side. So they have exhausts sucking the air out of the hot side, and then AC pushing it into the cold side. So the air goes down and flows through the hardware and then back up. They keep it cool, just to keep the air moving around. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing is crazy. It's pretty crazy. I took a tour. I'd never been to a kind of, you know, industrial data center. And then I went on a tour with the company about 6 months ago, and I was just blown away. It's incredible.
All over the world.
All over the place. It is. The downside of it, you want to find that sweet spot, right? Where, because the further you are away from your customers is time. So you want to find that sweet spot where you're close enough that there's some benefit to being in that spot, whether it's like, I think, is that Google or Facebook have this really cool data center somewhere in Scandinavia where actual ocean water flows through the data center and keeps all the machines cool. It's crazy. It looks like a James Bond movie. It's just insane. I'm sorry. Question.
Mm-hmm. Is that 125 for every second, or is it the inverse 1 over
125
per second?
Oh, it's the first one. It's 125. It's
125
every second. So the cache server in. 125
every second.
Yes. Yes. So this machine here will. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this machine here will allow 125 requests per second. Okay, I think I'm actually almost done. Okay, so some practical considerations/limitations. I think it's actually been really good. You guys have like found all the issues with what I'm doing, so I appreciate that. Practical considerations. We don't ask. You could design a very naive system. A perfect system would be everyone agrees what's going on every request. Because then if you could do that fast enough, then no one would ever, you would never go above the limit, and you would have a perfect, complete picture. Oh, sorry. To give some context for that, going back, the time from here to here, i.e. the time from when everything's cool, and then all of a sudden it's not cool, the limit is being exceeded, the time from here to when it's back to being cool again, everything's fine, is, I'm aiming for 5 seconds. At the moment, it's 45 seconds. That sucks. So 5 seconds. So basically, for if we assume that it's 5 seconds, for those 5 seconds, the system is unrestrained. So it'll be doing as many as it can allow, i.e. it'll be doing 2,000 requests per second for 5 seconds. Latency is basically the amount of the time that it takes to receive information. So me talking is coming at you at 720 miles an hour, the speed of sound. So that divided by the distance that we're at is a very short number. So our latency in communication is very low. When a machine wants to send a message to another machine all the way around the other side of the world, like those green arrows right there,
that can be on the order of 210 milliseconds, which is 0.2 of a second. It doesn't sound like a long time, but you have to do that to 10,000 machines around the world. So, give or take, yeah. And unfortunately, it's not, you know, as the crow flies, it's more like and then across one of these big cables and then to get to the actual destination. Yeah, so it's around, you know, 0.2, 0.3 of a second, best case. Some of the really interesting and kind of, again, practical considerations come in when, like, everything will work one time. You know what I mean? If it was just this machine asking four people, my job would be super easy. The problem is, it's this machine, and it's asking thousands of machines here, and thousands of machines here, and thousands of machines here. And any one of those requests can take just a little bit longer. Maybe something along the way dropped one of the particular packets, and so it had to retry, which happens all the time. The internet's designed to be tolerant for those sorts of kind of just little blips, like, yep, one little bit of machine will just blip. But when you have a system like this, you become very sensitive to those outliers. So, like, 99.999% of the requests may come back in 400 milliseconds, because it's 200 milliseconds there, 200 milliseconds back. So it's half a second before you've done anything. Most of the things may come back in 400 milliseconds, but you might get that one that takes 5 seconds, which is makes everything else very, very hard. Yes, sorry, I heard a couple of questions.
Would it be appropriate to introduce the concept of Tor and BitTorrent at this point?
Sure. Do you want to do it? I'll try to speak to that. I'm. Right. I apologize if I gave that impression. You have to talk to everyone. When you go to that global phase, you have to go to 12,000. So it's a little bit different than this diagram. You would here try to establish 12,000 connections. You would from here establish one connection here and then get this one to talk to everyone close to it. Just because then every time you go over these long green arrows, it takes a long time. So you send just one request and say, yes, exactly. So you have like a friend on each continent, and you're like, hey, dude, talk to everyone around you, work out what you're doing, and get back to me. Yeah. Yes?
Does it make sense to have a master area that kind of does a watch by timer and watch what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
The status guy?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That is absolutely one way to do it. The part of the issue that we have is failover, as you said, knowing how long do you wait for someone. You know what I mean? So you have your master, right? In that scenario, you have the person that you know that you need to talk to. And let's say you have a person, and you have a backup, and then you have another backup, because you're really paranoid. So you send your request off, and the person doesn't respond. And you're like, how long should I wait? How long, you know, should I go to the next person? When should I do that? And any reasonable amount of time there kind of blows the rest of your stuff out of proportion. So even if you wait 2 seconds, and if you fail twice, then that's 6 seconds, and I'm already, you know, I can't wait 6 seconds. I have to do it in five. So the way we address that is everyone is a master. Everyone can do it all. Everyone can do it all. So, because if you have that, then we have this whole other bottleneck that we need to be very careful we don't exceed. Because that master itself will only be able to do a certain number of requests for that job every second. By making everyone a master, we can spread that load all the way around. The other thing that gets us is we can fall over very, very quickly. So we can send a request. If they don't come back basically straight away, we say, okay, fine, next one. Yeah. Google has a very cool term for that. It's called the tail at scale, which is basically if you have a diagram of where the y-axis is the number of machines that respond, and sorry, the y-axis is the number of machines that respond, and the x-axis is time, you get this like tail effect, where the vast majority of the machines respond very, very quickly, but as you go out over time, there's still machines way out over here. if you wait for it, they'll come back and be like, hey, and you're like, well, that was like half an hour ago. So part of the reason that we kind of elect our buddies, and everyone is a master, so we have the whole, everyone in like North America can be my buddy, but I just pick, in this scenario, where this machine has exceeded its limit and needs to ask this machine in North America, any one of the, say, there's 1,000 machines here, any one of those machines can answer me, but I pick just one, and then if it doesn't respond, I pick another one, and one of them will eventually come back. So the reason why we break it down that way is because the time that it takes to talk to people close to you is very low. Basically within, and I'm sorry, I'm introducing more terms, POP is a point of presence, which is exactly the same thing as a data center. I don't know, computing people, as I'm sure everyone knows, love to invent new words for the same thing. So it's POP, it's data center, whatever. So inside a POP, the latency or the time it takes to talk to people is very, very low, less than 1 millisecond. When I tested it this afternoon, it was like 700 microseconds on one of our slower POPs. To go between POPs, i.e. from South America to North America or from North America to Australia, is potentially very large. Last time I tested it was 210 milliseconds. Another practical consideration we need to build in the system is, like, this scenario that we have here is pretty simple because only this guy exceeded the limit at that particular point in time. If everyone had have exceeded the limit together, there would have been a lot more green lines. And then every one of those green lines is time and is energy that the system is spending trying to work something out rather than doing its job. So it's actually contributing to the problem because then there's less resources to do the actual job. So you have to be careful. You don't want to spend all your time trying to work out what you're doing and none of the time doing your job. So it just so happens that... So the way that we solve this is with a cache because we're a whole caching thing. Caching is what we do. So what happens... So we don't have any protections in place for this at the moment. If someone asks, we can handle the case where everyone asks, tries to ask the question at the same instant. The way we handle it is each one of the POPs will remember what happened in exactly the same way as they remember what the response is for a particular website. They will remember the count. And to go back to your earlier point about purging, like how do you know when to give up the value? Does it time out, or do you actively purge it? We set a very low timeout on that value. So if everyone asks at once, the first person will cause it to be worked out, and then we remember that number for like 5 seconds. But 5 seconds is enough. And this is, sorry, just to my earlier point about the tail at scale. What happens if a single server is overloaded and it takes a long time to respond? The answer is we just try a different server. There's just to wrap up, lots of fun issues and things that we're still working out. Yes?
Software that runs in these servers, it doesn't control everything.
Yeah.
Is that Apache software?
No. Very similar, very, very similar, though. So Apache is... for anyone who doesn't know, an open source web server piece of software. At least that's how it started. Now it's a whole foundation. But it was kind of one of the first pieces of software which can serve websites. That was its job. And it was pretty good at it, you know, back in the day. Unfortunately, things have progressed, basically, and the amount of the scale required for web servers these days is far greater. Apache has other things which are good. As opposed to the Apache web server, they have the Apache Traffic Server, which is basically a much better version of the same thing. It's very, very similar to that. It's something we developed in-house called Sailfish. Yeah. Basically, we name all our software projects after fish, and Sailfish is the fastest fish. So we call it Sailfish. Yes, it was forked from an open source project. So basically, someone had an open source project, and that project was called LIGHTD, L-I-G-H-T-T-P-D, pronounced LIGHTD. And in 2006, when Edgecast started, they were looking around for kind of the basis for this piece of software. What can we use that already exists, and we can just add things to it rather than having to build everything from scratch. And so they picked LIGHTD. So it's a heavily modified version of LIGHTD. Yeah.
Sailfish.
Sailfish. yeah. Oh, like what would you see if you went to it? I think someone else kind of hit on it. If you send the request, you basically, there's a few options. In the next version of this, you would see this nice pretty message that said, I'm sorry, you know, we're currently overloaded. We'll be back in a second. There's a wide range of things that you can see. And we're building the system to be able to do different things. One of the more interesting cases is you wouldn't see anything. Your machine would just pause. Which is the ideal case, because you then, you know, so your machine pauses for a second, and then it goes and gets to the website. And you have no idea that anything happened. It just took, like, 1 second longer to load. Most people wouldn't notice that. But that making everyone wait 1 second is potentially enough to bring the rate limit down. So that's kind of an ideal scenario. You wouldn't see anything. If I do my job really well and you're lucky, you wouldn't see anything. All the way to the thing just sits there. We've all seen the spinning wheel.
I seem to remember getting a message, this server or website is not responding at this time.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is kind of built into the protocol for talking to websites. It's like a status code that specifically says, hey, this machine is not responding right now. Yeah. So I think it's a 503 is the code. Yeah. Zero. Oh, yeah, sorry. The question was, everything that I'm talking about is the Verizon kind of current solution for rate limiting. How much interaction does that have with AT&T? That was the question? All other service providers all around the world. Zero is the answer. There is no standard for communicating what's happening on the network at this level, which is kind of a bummer because... if we can't even do that with very well understood protocols. It's actually very sad. So we have the internet kind of community has this protocol that called BGP, which I've mentioned a couple of times, which is used to determine how to send requests to places in the quickest way possible. It's very efficient. It's amazing. It works incredibly well. It powers the internet. We don't have anything like that for anything to do with security. It sucks. The whole internet would be a much better place if we could do that. And it's even stupider than that. There are very simple rules that everyone could put in place, which is simply, I'm not going to send a packet that isn't from me. So when you're writing a letter, it's the same way that it's very similar. When it's the same way that computers talk, basically at the moment, I can be here and I can pop something in the mailbox that says it came from Canada. Right? And the person will get it and they'll be like, oh, it came from Canada. So when they respond, it goes back to Canada. It doesn't actually come to me. That is a specific sort of an attack called an amplification attack, because it means that if everyone around the world popped letters in the thing and they were addressed to this one house in Canada, you can imagine that the responses would all go to this one house in Canada and the poor thing would get totally overwhelmed with those letters. If every post office said, this thing says it's from Canada, not from Canada. If this thing was being sent from Canada, I wouldn't have gotten it. And the post office could just throw it away. So that equivalent system is very easy to implement, but it requires everyone to agree. And nobody agrees. Basically. So that sucks. Interestingly, the AT&T AT&T was what we called a licensed customer up for the last 5 years. So if we were using AT&T's CDN, it was actually our CDN. We sold them the software and ran it for them. And then they decided to build their own, yeah. Actually, not too familiar with the stock market one. I'm not as familiar as I should be. It's really hard to say, and it's tough because nobody wants to say, "Oh yeah, my stuff was insecure and I got, you know, creamed." Nobody wants to say that, so they say things like, "Oh, we had an unscheduled maintenance," and it's like, "No, you didn't." It's really hard. It's really, really hard. Some companies will come out and be like, "Yes, we got compromised." I think because when customer information is compromised, you have to disclose it. I think that there must be some law around that. That, yeah, if you don't, then you're in trouble. So that's the only thing that people will say. Oh yeah, you know, what was it? There was one just recently that was like. It was like 21 million records. I'm like, oh my god. Oops. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Which is actually a really good point. So DDoS attacks, or these distributed denial of service attacks that we're trying to defend against, are the dumbest form of computer security attack in the world. It's interesting because they're so common because they're so stupid. They're so easy to do. All you need is a lot of machines and they just blindly send requests. The rest of computer security, the whole field, is way more interesting, where you're trying to find that very specially crafted request that will trick the machine into doing something. It's kind of like, like a very accurate sniper rifle, where you just want to hit just that one thing and you're very careful and it takes a long time. And DDoSs are just like a bazooka. But unfortunately, they're both very effective. Yeah.
Your division of Verizon.
Yeah.
You would be considered
what, a web hosting company? Close. See, I also was confused about that when I joined. I'm like, how is this not just hosting websites? And the answer is. Our stuff just gets deleted all the time, and it's fine. So when basically a cache can get removed, and it's fine. It can get totally cleared out, and it's okay. I'm not saying that well. Basically, the difference is, if everything got deleted from our servers, no big deal. If everything got deleted from this machine right here, then it's gone. But because it's all stored here, we're just keeping like a local copy just to make it faster. If everything gets deleted, no big deal. That's the only difference. Yes.
Definitely. Do you have redundancy in the
Commerce Cloud? We try to, absolutely. It's harder in some places than there's another. It's called the BRIC, which is Brazil, Russia, India and China. Getting data centers. Yeah. Oh, what's this?
Singapore.
Oh, we have something in Singapore. But getting data centers into those four countries is impossible. It's so hard. And it just costs such an. We have this tiny little data center in Sao Paulo in Brazil. And it's like a hundredth of the size of our other ones. And we paid. Oh yeah, they're there. They don't let people into them. I'm not going to say anymore. I'm not going to say anymore, especially to. I don't know. I think there must be something like that. We had to like grease a lot of palms to get a data center in there. It was super painful. Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. This is it. Wait, that's it. So. if I do my job right and the system launches, hopefully you don't hear about any major websites going offline in the next couple of months. Thank you for having me. Sure.